Our speaker tonight is Tom English. Tom English flirted with creationism in his teens and went so far as to deliver an anti-evolution talk to his biology classmates. What led him to abandon his naive beliefs about the truth and reconciliation of scripture and science and to embrace methodological naturalism and scientific investigation was a combination of studies in the Bible and philosophy of science. After earning bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology and English, respectively, at Mississippi College, and master's and doctoral degrees in computer science at Mississippi State University, he began investigating evolution in computational processes. He independently proved what came to be known as the no free lunch theorem for optimization, and subsequently published 6 papers related to it. In empirical research, he obtained by computational evolution a predictor of annual sunspots activity that was far more accurate than any previously reported. Tom is a senior member at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers and has served as associate editor of the IEEE Transactions on Evolutionary Computation. His most recent scholarly publication, co-authored by Gary Greenwood, is Intelligent Design and Evolutionary Computation, Chapter 1 of Design by Evolution. Please welcome Tom English.
So do I have any time left after that?
This is a trick question, actually. I won't be answering it. It's far too ambiguous for me to take on. I'll really leave that for the intelligent design creationists. Incidentally, they like to insist that you call them intelligent design theorists or whatever. They deplore that term creationist. And I'll give you some justification for pinning that on them a little later on. I am not a carbon chauvinist. I like that term. I don't think life had to turn out anything like the life that we presently know. So it's really hard to say what's the probability of things that I can't even begin to imagine. And we'll talk a bit more about that later on. And there are several different kinds of probability, and those don't get talked about very much. And I am going to get into that tonight. I may stumble a bit with that. This is the first time I've tried this approach, but I think it really sheds a lot of light on what the games the intelligent design creationists play. You know, what is the physical universe? That's under a huge debate right now. Do we want to talk about the observable universe, the observed universe? Do we want to go with the string theorists, the M theorists, and guess that there are 11 dimensions, that we're only looking at 4 of them? You know, that's just all over the place right now. Intelligent design creationists, in contrast, are perfectly willing to treat life as we know it as some sort of target that nature somehow had to achieve. At the same time, they'll tell you that life is aimed at a target. It's trying to achieve a target. They've assumed it and they've concluded it at the same time. Sometimes they do that in very subtle ways, but it's almost always there in their arguments. They aren't very clear on what kind of probability they're talking about in general. And one of their key assumptions is that the material universe is finite. There's really no warrant for saying that. But you'll see in the next point there, they have to say that because if they argue otherwise, if they allow any other possibility, then everything the laws of nature happen somewhere, sometime. That's not too good for them. They want to rule out some possibilities so they can tell you that supernatural stuff caused things to happen. They'll argue further that if material causes don't account for phenomena that we observe, then what's left over? Something non-material must have intervened. Okay, so the general outline of what we're going to go over here. They get a lot of mileage out of big fancy mathematical arguments. and a lot of their a lot of the followers, a lot of the minions of IDC are highly impressed by that. And I'm afraid that when it comes to general science, a lot of people are impressed by mathematics. I sort of want to deflate that a bit. Mathematical modeling really isn't so different from other sorts of modeling that are more tangible or easier for you to understand. I probably have a little too material, too much material on that. I'm going to go through that pretty rapidly, but hopefully you'll get an idea that there's no big deal to math. And I'm going to distinguish three kinds of probability. I'm not going to take into mathematics at all. In fact, I don't even have a slide that mentions that probabilities lie between 0 and 1. I assume that most of you know that, although probabilities really don't have to be assigned numbers. And I think I'm going to pretty well demolish the IDCist argument. I've gotten steadily better at getting to the essence of it over the years, and hopefully tonight you're going to get the most direct attack on various aspects of it that I've ever made. What I'm going to do, in effect, is to hack through the thicket and get to the house of cards, I hope. Okay, now, if you go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, there's a pretty long article on models in science. Incidentally, that's just about my favorite resource on the internet. And I'm going to treat models as descriptions of physical entities. And there's not a whole lot of debate about that. That's not without some problems, but it's good enough for us tonight. And in general, what scientists do is to manipulate models, and what they get by manipulating them amounts to explanation of whatever the model entity is, or predictions about how it will behave in further observations or experimentation. Now, it's really easy for a material model, I'll give you some examples a little bit, to understand what this means. When I bring in mathematical expressions, then if you're not comfortable with math, it seems very different. Again, it's really not. There's a famous one for you. It's probably near and dear to many of you here. How welcome to see that. This is pieces of wire bent at angles arranged in a double helix. It's the Watson-Crick model in the London Museum of Science. Of course, what they did with this was to take all the empirical data they could get their hands on at the time, especially data from Franklin and Wilkins in 1952. That was essential. You may have heard about photo 51, which Franklin produced. Wilkins carried it to Watson with our knowledge. With that additional data and some playing with this physical model, they managed to piece together the structure of DNA. That's a rather famous story. Now, it's not only that they explained the observations with this model, but people could, you know, walk up to it, walk around it, look at it, and make predictions about how DNA might be replicated in life. So this model constrained future scientific investigation. That's a really important function of models. Here's one that I hit upon back in May, I think, and I really love this little model. There's a story behind this, and saying how startled they got, I think I'll spare you that. It has to do with a creationist spouting off online that humans can't build ornithopters because the control equations are too complicated. Well, not so. This little gizmo weighs the same as a swallowtail. It's a little different, though, in the way that it works the wings. It has a crank here and a rubber band. You wind up the rubber band using the crank. And what comparison of different physical models, material models, reveals is that it's crucial what material the wings are made of. But that's not the whole story. That pattern of veins is essential to control flight in the swallowtail. And with the right arrangement of the veins and the right choice of material, the researchers here were able to get a good match for the rather distinctive flight of the swallowtail. They beat their wings very slowly for butterflies. They know that butterflies fly as they do. What does this tell us also? This is something that, just a sidebar here, the people often think of animals as solving these incredible problems to control their bodies. The thing is, bodies have co-evolved with control, and what a number of researchers are learning now is that if you mimic the materials in the bodies of animals, it's really not so difficult to control them. In this case, the controlled flight just falls right out. To my knowledge, this is the first ornithopter. I may be wrong about that. All right, so now, seems like a big jump, right? We've moved to Newton's second law, and many of you saw this in high school or college. And so it's the relationship between force and acceleration. Again, what this is a description of nature, of an aspect of nature. I heard somebody refer to Newton's theorems not long back. No, these aren't proven facts about nature. There is no such thing as a proven fact about nature. Not mathematically proven. Now, you've heard before that mathematics is the language of God. No, it's the language of physicists. Is Newton's law exactly correct? No, it's not. It's possible to measure, let's go with mechanics in general, Newtonian mechanics in general. It's possible to measure the trajectory of a body in motion precisely enough to tell that there are errors in the prediction of the model. And so it's not 100% correct, yet it's still a very good model. And in modern reformulations it's essentially the same aspects of nature, there is no concept of force. So the question arises, in what sense was Newton's, is the law true? In what sense is Newtonian mechanics true? Over the years, I've come to avoid the T word entirely in talking about science. I'll speak of scientific models, scientific explanations, and the degree of utility of a model or of an explanation, but I won't say that it's true or false categorically. So, we've all heard that physicists prove things. What do they prove? Well, a proof is basically this. You start out with a description of something. That's the model. That's one or more mathematical expressions. And then manipulation of those, I've talked before about manipulation of the model, manipulation of those expressions is how you come up with a proof. One of the important things to establish by a proof is that your model is consistent with itself. You don't want to predict that under such and such circumstances, the system's going to have temperature of minus 23 and also temperature of 98 degrees Fahrenheit. That's an example of of inconsistency of a model. Now you can also prove theorems that follow from the model, and some of them amount to just understanding how the model works. A model is essentially a conceptual tool, and sometimes you just sort of need to fiddle with it to figure out what you've got in your hands, you know, what you're working with. And then other theorems constitute predictions of nature. Now, you haven't proven anything about nature because you can go and check those predictions by observation or by experiment, which is, of course, controlled observation. And you may find out that those predictions are wrong. And that means you need to go back and correct the model. At least it's bigger. Sometimes a model will predict lots of things well and just a few things wrong by a little bit, and you say it's a pretty good model. No model is totally correct. Every model is to some degree a simplification of whatever it describes. In fact, there's a lot of talk about use of mathematical expressions to compress data. For instance, we had a little bit ago, F equals MA. That's a very compact expression of a lot of things you can look at in nature. It's in essence data compression. Now I'm going to go through an example that I really don't know anything about. I could have pulled up examples of modeling from my own field, but they probably wouldn't have been very interesting to you. This is the most sensational example I know of. First, let's consider the standard model of particle physics. This is a sensational achievement of the 20th century. Putting this together, there was a lot of mathematical deduction to hypothesize particles. There was a lot of work with particle accelerators to confirm that hypothesized particles actually existed. I believe there were some cases in which particles were observed and then they needed to be fit mathematically into the standard model. So it worked both ways, guessing that particles should exist, and then trying to figure out about particles that were observed. And at any rate, this all fits together very neatly now. And this had just barely been completed when somebody said, well, no, we need to look for some more particles. We need to try to extend this. Why is that? Well, there's a standard model of particle physics. There's also a standard model of cosmology. And things are really desperate here, actually. How many of you knew that already? Yeah. We were just looking at a table describing the standard model of what's called baryonic matter. That's atoms. That's the ordinary sort of stuff we have right here with us. That accounts for only 5% of the mass energy of the observable cosmos. That ain't much. Now, it's been known since the 30s that things look strange in some galactic clusters. There were some objects orbiting way too fast, which suggested that there had to be matter in there, but it wasn't emitting any sort of light, any sort of radiation. There was no way to see it. And so there's been missing matter for 70 to 80 years now. And at this point, we don't really know much about where it is. We know that it doesn't move at relativistic speeds, close to the speed of light. And we know that it doesn't emit or absorb radiation, which that says in essence that it's invisible. And a recent 1998 and stunning discovery was that the acceleration, that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And your intuition would tell you, the Big Bang is like an explosion, it should be slowing down, but it's not. And so there's now this hypothetical dark energy of vacuum pressure, which is pulling the universe apart. Nobody really knows what that is. Nobody really knows what cold dark matter is either. These are things that constitute, that amount to an attempt to salvage the classical physical picture of the cosmos. Now, there's also a suggestion that Newtonian dynamics can be modified, and that has some merits and some demerits. The string theorists are, of course, the M theorists are, of course, crazy. They'll say just about anything without telling you how to actually test for it. And I'm sorry if I haven't offended anyone with that, but I often don't see much difference between the sorts of things that the M theorists say and the creationists say. There are some many and striking correspondences between them. And the M theorists are willing to suggest that the missing matter is actually in some of those seven dimensions that we can't see. So it's not some sort of different matter, but we just can't see it. I don't think a whole lot of that, but it's not impossible. Well, inner supersymmetry. There are symmetries in the standard model of particle physics, and what some physicists have done is to introduce to that existing mathematical structure, that existing mathematical model, an algebraic structure which introduces a new symmetry, a supersymmetry. And this gives all of the existing particles partners. And each of the partners differs from its known particle with one-half spin, by one-half spin. And to make this model physically realistic, you have to do something called symmetry breaking. Don't ask me to explain it because I don't understand it. My understanding is this, broad understanding is this, there's not a unique way of doing that. So there's not really just one supersymmetry model. But there is at least one model that predicts the existence of the neutralino, which is not really like a neutron, but it has the right properties to serve as cold dark matter. Now, when I say it has the right properties, this is a hypothetical entity. We don't know that it exists. This is predicted by doing mathematical manipulation of the existing model, by taking it, slapping on some more mathematical structure, coming up with something that physicists say, that seems plausible. And I think there's a certain more amount of aesthetic judgment in it, to tell you the truth. And so the experimentalists say, we don't have any other ideas what to look for. We're just poking around in the dark, in the dark energy, in the cold dark matter otherwise, this at least gives us something to try to define. Unfortunately, they haven't found it. And the efforts go back to 1990 or so. So it's been about 20 years now. Until the early 2000s, they were able to say quite legitimately that their instruments weren't sensitive enough. About six, seven years now, they've had a pretty fair chance at detecting the neutralino and have not succeeded. So some physicists are starting to say now, maybe we better look for something else. So the moral in this is that proofs yield extensions of models, not facts of nature. When we prove something that adds to what we already had in the model, it doesn't really prove anything about nature. Now moving on to probability. And I want to mention up front that probability is controversial. Something related to probability, information, which the intelligent design people love to talk about, is even more controversial. I think that's part of why they get into it, just to muddy the waters. At any rate, philosophers do contest the distinctions I'll be making, the three probabilities. Some say one kind doesn't exist. Others say another kind doesn't exist. Others say another kind can only be used in certain ways. And I don't think we really have to worry about that here because the creationists essentially concede that it's appropriate to use two of the types. And the third, I think, is necessary in giving a good account of the games that they play with probability. So I'm going to go ahead and use it anyway. And this guy, Hugh Miller, whom I'm mentioning, he's professor emeritus of philosophy at Cambridge University, and he's really famous for his work in probability. So I'm drawing on a good source. You'll see that I put his name at the bottom of some slides. Okay, so the three types of probability, I'm going to start out by giving you some examples. First is physical probability, and that's also known as chance. And so smokers have a greater chance of getting cancer than non-smokers have. Not a pleasant thought for some folks, but it gives you the idea anyway. This coin toss is unbiased. It has equal chances of landing heads and tails. Okay, now epistemic probability, there's no shorthand name for that. Astronomical data makes it very probable that our universe had a beginning. New evidence makes it improbable that the butler did it. And then there's subjective probability, also known as credence. I think it will probably rain tonight. We're all very familiar with this sort of probabilistic statement. I'll bet you 4-1 that Pink Gin doesn't win the, considering where this comes from, I'll say Derby. Now, the thing to understand about chances is that they are real features of the world. That's the way we're thinking of them anyway. So they are just what they are. It doesn't matter what we think about them. It doesn't matter if we have ever thought of them at all, have conceived of them in any way. And we don't come up with chances by considering evidence. They're out there. They're in the thing itself. And certainly our opinion doesn't have any impact on them. Now, epistemic probabilities are essentially about evidence. They are measures. The epistemic probability measures the degree to which the evidence confirms or disconfirms a hypothesis about the world. Now, things are a little hazy here, but they don't seem to be matters of pure opinion. There is something objective about them. We have objective evidence which leads to some conclusions that are more sane, in a sense, than others. Now, as for credences, these subjective probabilities, they just measure how strong people, strongly people believe in propositions. Incidentally, a proposition is a true-false statement. It's either totally true, totally false, nothing in between. Now, the way to understand a credence, a chance was a property of an object in the world, something in the world. A credence is a property of a person, belongs to the person, not to what the person has the credence about, what the person has this belief about. They are very much matters of opinion. Now let's work to an example. This is a famous example of something that is putatively, irreducibly complex. That's a term that is due to the intelligent design creationist Michael Behe, the author of Darwin's Black Box. The idea with something that's irreducibly complex is that all of its pieces are needed for it to function, and Behe's claim is that evolution couldn't possibly have assembled them into a functional whole. In this case, the ossicles function as a lever. Generally, they amplify sound, but there are also muscles that are part of the system which will attenuate also. For instance, a fun fact to know and tell, a bat, when sending out its high-intensity chirp that it uses in echolocation, will in effect clamp down the ossicles to keep from driving itself batty, I guess, would be a All right, so evidence. Evidence from paleontology. You ought to know from that that I'm addressing what sort of probability? Epistemic probability. And what was the hypothesis that I introduced? That an evolutionary process produced this arrangement of three bones in the middle ear. So this, well, the way this proceeds in time is actually from here through here to here and up to here. Best I could do with the figures that I lifted from Wikipedia without spending time cutting them up into pieces. So I've gone blank on this. I think this is a, let's just not say. At any rate, at one point, comparative anatomists, the point was the early 19th century, prior to Darwin, comparative anatomists had noticed the analogy of these three bones to these. But they weren't thinking in terms of evolution at that point, so maybe that's, maybe God just used bones differently for different species. And then, of course, with evolutionary theory, there was there came the hypothesis that some evolutionary process had turned this into this. And there is actually a a fine fossil record in this case to demonstrate to back up the transition from this to this. Here is one of the transitional forms, one of the forms that came in the middle. And how did this happen? Well, this organism has a doubly jointed jaw. And in developing, as that evolved, these bones got moved back, got moved more in the locality of the ear, and that was an early step toward getting them where they needed to be arranged into the ossicles. And this is just a picture of what they look like in the in a modern mammal. This is a prototype. Now, there's not only the fossil evidence, there's evidence from embryology, early in development of the of mammal embryos. The bones that will be the ossicles are attached to the jaw. Then they break away and they move up to the middle ear. Now, that's quite an incredible thing if that's not related to the what we know from the fossil record. I'm not going to say precisely that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, but there is some degree of that. There are reasons for there to be connections between development and phylogenetic history. So as for this question about the probability that the ossicles evolved in this irreducibly complex structure, supposedly irreducibly complex, it doesn't look like the structure is irreducibly complex. It looks like it is evolved. The epistemic probability is high. We have a lot of evidence to support the claim that there was a gradual evolution. And it's incredible, actually. That's a contradiction. We feel remarkable surprise at the way it happened. It's extraordinary that jaw bones turn into this lever in your middle ear, but that's what the physical evidence says. And it also happened over a long period of time. There weren't any saltations, there weren't any big jumps. There's not any step where you can say, well, gee, what were the chances of that happening? It's only when you take the starting point and compare it to the end point and you say, oh, that could never happen. But if you look at the trajectory, the evolutionary pathway, each and every little step is no big deal. So why is the credence low for creationists? This is not always what they do, but very often they claim that there is some sort of proof. And when I start out talking about proof, now when you put proof in its place, they don't keep proof in its place. They want to say that they can start with the laws of nature as they understand them. Of course, if you look at our understanding of the cosmos, you have to wonder, do we really understand the laws of nature? People say, yeah, we understand the laws of nature. And we'll prove to you that the chances of that happening were so ridiculously small, that's effectively impossible. So what they do is to take this chance, this physical probability, which they claim to have computed to arrive at from first principles of basis of physical law, and they will make that their epistemic probability, their subjective probability, their credence. he'll say, we're going to believe in the chance that we computed. We're not going to believe in the evidence. We're not going to accept that high epistemic probability. Now, there is an alternative that, interpretation of what they're doing, and just out of fairness, I'll mention that this isn't the way what I'm focused on. But you could say, perhaps, that they are deciding that the proof is better evidence than the fossil record and what we know from embryology. I hope you're getting some idea here of how probabilities of fundamentally different sorts are being compared and are being turned into credence, how much a person really believes in an explanation of something. And so the reason I really think it's appropriate to talk about credence is that we know that they are scrambling to hang on to prior belief about God's creation of all of this and how God created all of this. They're not willing to say that God is, say, a deistic God and set all in motion beginning and evolution accounts for all perfectly. So that's a subjective thing, and I think that's what makes it appropriate to talk about their credence. Now, as for this matter of proof of low chance, as I said, they always appeal to some law of nature. William Dembski, the guy I love most to hate. The reason for that, incidentally, in my bio sketch, there was mentioned the fact that I independently proved the main no free lunch theorem. Unfortunately, I didn't publish first. And the guys who published the first Stirrer article have about 2,000 citations for that now. I don't have anywhere close to that. But I did do it at the same time that they did. Dembski came out with a book in 2003, I think it was, No Free Lunch. And now he and his collaborator, Bob Marks at Baylor, are working a lot with the No Free Lunch Theorem and are doing things related to it. And I get cited in most of their papers, which is a dubious distinction. But anyway, one of the things that Dembski advanced, and now Dembski and Marx have advanced, is a law of conservation of information. What's kind of funny about that is that in No Free Lunch, it was conservation of complex specified information, something that's defined in one way. Complex specified information just didn't pan out very well for Dembski. He sort of silently let that go. His acolytes are still hammering away at it. It's really bad. And he's gone to something that is somewhat more reasonable now, and he's working with Bob Marks on this. It's called active information. There's a new law of conservation of information that refers to active information. So there's still a law of conservation of information, but no mention that they entirely change the type of information that they're talking about. There are still some diehards out there who think that evolution can't happen because of the second law of thermodynamics. That's a really old argument, and it has been so thoroughly debunked, it just amazes me that it keeps popping out. But it does. So again, the idea is go to some... Now, in the first case, this law is not well established. It's not widely accepted. At least the second law of thermodynamics is. The basic idea is that there's some law, and it's appealing to it as a higher form of argument than appealing to the evidence that's been collected empirically. So I think I've already indicated the next new point. Points pretty well. I discussed this pretty well. Another way to encapsulate this, if I tossed a coin now and we all saw it land on edge and it was very clear to you all there was no trick in it, you'd have evidence that it happened. The epistemic probability that a very low chance event had occurred would be high. Low chance events can happen, and we can have evidence, very solid evidence of them when they do happen. An IDCist, in effect, would tell you, no, the laws of nature say that the chance of that is so small that it couldn't have just been natural, it couldn't have just been material causation, something non-material, which is a code word now for supernatural. Something supernatural must have intervened and made that coin stand on its edge. Now, as I mentioned before, this whole matter of chances and evolution, the chances of evolution, is problematic. This event of the oscils emerging is presumably a one-time event, and talking about the chances of something that's not repeatable is a little tricky in the first place. It's also a past event. There's actually an argument that the chance should be assigned to that as one. Not a terribly satisfying argument, but it is actually out there in the philosophical literature. Now, if we want to talk about the probability of this arising in the course of affairs in the biosphere on Earth, we need to know what the past conditions are. That would seem to indicate that we need a time machine. We don't really know what things were like back then. We make inferences on what information we can gather. But perhaps a bigger problem that is we're essentially making a statement about the trajectory that evolution has taken through some space of possibilities. I mentioned earlier that, well, life, Jim, but not as we know it. We cannot imagine all the possible forms of life that might have emerged on Earth if things had gone a little differently. At the time of the pteropods, would you really imagine that Stegosaurus was coming along or the T-Rex was coming along? I think probably not. And you certainly wouldn't have imagined if you were an alien visiting Earth at that time, you probably wouldn't have imagined that something like us would be here eventually. I think those aliens are probably not all that much like us, but that's my bias, I suppose. So the space in which the trajectory occurs, the evolutionary trajectory occurs, is what Stuart Kaufman calls the space phase. He pointed out in a lecture to a group of atheists earlier this year, we don't even know the phase space. And what it boils down to is that when we don't know the space of alternatives, every way that evolution might have gone, we can't really talk about probability, about physical chances. So I'm saying the whole thing is ill-defined in the first place. And the ID creationists always frame some particular aspect of nature that's very convenient for them to deal with, and they leave out this bigger picture. They artificially define a space of alternatives, and that lets them come up with the mathematical display exhibition that they want. But it's not really valid, is what I'm saying. So whenever you hear this sort of thing, you can respond, no, you don't really know what the chances are. Now, one of the things that evolutionists do to to define a search, to define chances, is to set up a space of alternatives somehow or another, whether it's justified or not, and then to say that evolution was searching for, say, the ossicles. Now, Darwinian theory says that precisely that there is no such search, there is no teleology, there is no direction toward an end. And if you start out saying that some incredibly small target in a range of possibilities had to be achieved, then the chance is going to be incredibly small. It's going to look ridiculous. But the thing is, evolution isn't trying to go in any particular direction. It's more like exploring, if you will, than searching. It's branching out opportunistically. It's not trying to get anywhere. It's not trying to find anything particular. What they're essentially doing is treating what has happened as though it had happened. We do not have to have obstacles to hear. In fact, it's a pretty weird contraption. Other things would have worked. Other things work in other species. Only the mammals have those, incidentally. They hear none of them, right? Now, as for this matter, what I'm doing now is going through some of the points that I brought up at first, and I'm hopefully dispatching with them. Now, there is absolutely no warrant for saying that the universe is finite or infinite, either one, though there are, of course, most of you have heard of this, I suppose, interpretations of quantum mechanics that suggest that there are many worlds, many universes. There are multiverse theories of various sorts now. There's a cyclic universe model that says that going back infinitely in time and up to the present, there's been a succession of big bangs and big crunches, big bang, big crunch, and so forth. And there are different ideas of that. As I mentioned before, if the universe is infinite, then everything possible under the laws of nature has happened somewhere, sometime, as at some locality in the space-time continuum. Of some universe, if there are multiple universes. What is the argument for a finite universe? There really is not one, except the IBCists are dead in the water if you take it away from them. They can't say that the probability of something happening by material cause is so low that you have to admit supernatural explanations. Okay, something that comes up very often in creationism, not just intelligent design creationism, is the idea that Emil Borel said in a book that things that are really improbable just don't happen. Well, he said that very casually. It was for lay people, and the creationists have really latched onto that. If you can show that something's really improbable, then it's effectively impossible. Perel, in fact, wrote that we should accept that there is abiogenesis and biological evolution. Now, I hope this makes sense to you. We have a bunch of really, really improbable events, and they're all equally improbable, and your sum of probabilities, that may be a fairly large probability. That means you can't throw any of them out. There is no such thing as a probability so small where you can ignore the possibility of something occurring. This is just a totally fallacious idea that keeps rolling and rolling and rolling in creationism, intelligent design creationism. wine, they basically can't do without it. So if you understand that it's wrong, if you understand this simple thing is wrong, you can undercut their arguments just right there. This is really the biggest thing that, biggest claim that the intelligent design creationists make. And they don't say it this way anymore. They used to, but they've become a bit more bold. Bill Dembski has written Intelligence Changes Probabilities. But all that he has to do to transform a probability into information, which is, you know, particularly since we're all computers and we're in the information age, blah, blah, blah. Excuse me, but I'm underwhelmed as a computer scientist. All he has to do to get information out of the probability is to take its negative logarithm. And he does that in places where there's no good reason to do it, actually. It's entirely gratuitous. But this plays into sort of a mythology that the creationists are developing. You might call it apologetics. That when humans change, use their intelligence to change probabilities, chances of events in nature, they're creating information. And that sits just fine with most people because they really don't stop and think about what that means in a scientific perspective, from the scientific perspective. If we have an open universe, a universe that's open in any way, if there's something invisible, intelligence, which is creating physical information, physical stuff, then we've got a real problem there. That means that something we can't observe is causing consequences, is causing things to happen in the phenomenal universe, in the material universe, things that we can observe. And how do you explain something like that? It amounts to letting sprites, imps, spirits of all sorts, demons, into scientific, into explanations of nature. And, oh, but it's intelligence. Everybody knows they're intelligent. As I say, it's just so easy for people to accept that. And this notion of intelligence is very casual for most people. In fact, I find even that people who are creationists find it very difficult for me to say, no, this whole notion of intelligence is highly problematic. People who actually study it treat it as a hypothetical construct. That means it doesn't have real existence. Can't cut you open to find intelligence anywhere. So whenever, my undergrad degree is in experimental psychology. I've studied psychometrics and I've worked on rat brains and run rats in the laboratory and stuff like that, many hours. And I've talked about intelligence in about, I think, 33 artificial intelligence courses. So at any rate, there's not really intelligence out there. We define it operationally when we want to study. We define in terms of operations what constitutes intelligence. And then when computers or animals do those things we call intelligence, intelligent, we impute intelligence to them. You don't live because you have life in you, and you don't do intelligent things because you have intelligence in you. Does that make any sense? So, intelligent design creationists don't get their hands slapped very often for that, and I think that is an important response that's been overlooked thus far. And I've talked long enough, I think. open it up for questions.
This podcast is a production of the Oklahoma Atheist, an organization dedicated to developing a community of like-minded individuals who share the ideas of free and critical thinking, and as opposed to the uncritical acceptance of faith-based ideas and norms. Our activities include dinner meetups, potlucks, family outings, debates, speeches, book clubs, volunteer opportunities, and political events and protests. We welcome all who share the ideals of critical thinking and who reject religious dogma. In addition to cultivating a community, we wish to contribute and put a face with all positive things non-believers and people with a secular viewpoint are doing in the world. If you'd like to know more, please visit us online at www.oklahomaatheist.com.
Perfect.